Radio.
The Revolution of Religion. The Dangerous Ideas of Christopher Dawson. A presentation by Carl Schmood at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 Colloquium.
Thank you very much, Campbell. Well, I'm struck as I have listened to the marvellous papers, and again, I'd like to just endorse Campbell's tribute to David for the organising of this conference, and to Archbishop Porteous for establishing the Dawson Centre and having the wisdom to invite David to head it up. But I'm struck by just how many notes of consonance there are, of conjunction, between the things that I'd like to say this afternoon and previous speakers. So I think that attests to the point about the colloquium, the conversation that David made in his opening remarks. Now, in this paper, I'd like to explore Christopher Dawson's ideas on religion and culture, which I've characterised in the subtitle as dangerous, in the context of the main theme of this colloquium. Now, the linking of Dawson and danger may at first seem a singular and even strange one. In appearance and manner, Dawson came across as anything but dangerous. He was the essence of the conservative gentleman. One might say an unmenacing man. Quiet, reserved, living the life largely of a reclusive scholar, he was physically frail, suffering from poor eyesight right through his life, as well as from bouts of depression. He was capable of enjoying private conversation, but not at home in a public setting. And when he went to America in the late 1950s to take up a chair at Harvard University, he gave guest lectures at various institutions. In New Orleans, a former student of his at Oxford, Father C.J. McNaspy, S.J., urged the organisers of his lecture to fix the microphone as close to his mouth as possible without his swallowing it. Dawson was, as Father McNaspy commented to me, always better to read than to listen to. But Dawson's delicate appearance and his mild manner, I think, belied the power and impact of his ideas. If he seemed to be conservative and contained in manner, his ideas were revolutionary in their potential. He revealed an extraordinary, and I think unrivalled, penetration of the connections between the mysteries of religious faith and the realities of cultural life. He recognised the profound and the pervasive links between religion and culture. And he showed in a wide array of historical studies, as many of you would know, particularly in relation to Europe, but also to other cultures, how central the concept of religion has been in human history and how profoundly the lived experience of religious faith has influenced the course of cultures throughout the ages. If I may offer an aside for a moment, ladies and gentlemen, I think Christopher Dawson highlights a difficulty in present-day discourse that's been touched on, I think, in a number of ways in our earlier discussions. It relates to the work, I think, of the Christopher Dawson Centre as well, and that is how inadequate are the terms of intellectual description we commonly hear. Conservative, progressive, traditional, liberal, and so on. I think they've become hopelessly confused and distinctly unhelpful, mixed up with assumptions about freedom and progress and liberation and enlightenment, which are rarely unpacked in the interests of intellectual clarity. There are all kinds of things that conservatives don't want to conserve, and all kinds of things that liberals are no longer liberal about. So the terms are, I think, increasingly misleading, and they don't apply descriptively, even though they continue to be used pejoratively. Let me turn now to the title of this paper, The Revolution of Religion. The common and conventional attitude, as we're well aware, is that religion is anything but revolutionary. It is, in fact, staid and boring, or more negatively, oppressive and abusive. Dawson, of course, took a distinctly different view. seeing religion in human history as immensely alive and creative, dynamic and liberating. Consider his picture of the roots of Western European culture in the Middle Ages, and I quote, "The centre of the common culture of Europe lay north of the Alps in the area between the Rhine, the Rhone and the Loire. And it was in this centre that the creative movements of medieval culture had their origin. In the 8th and 9th centuries, it was the centre of the Carolingian Empire and the Carolingian culture. In the 10th and 11th centuries, it was the source of the movement of monastic and ecclesiastical reform, which had its centre in Lorraine and Burgundy. And it was the alliance of these two movements with the papacy which determined the form of medieval Christendom and the character of its culture. So too in the following period, this area was the source of the crusading movement and of the Cistercian reform, and the centre of the university movement, of the scholastic philosophy, and of Gothic architecture and art." Now, in visualising this sketch of the cultural importance and impact of religion, I think one can appreciate the comment of the English author and actor Robert Speight, who said that when reading Dawson, the centuries lie before you like a map. So Dawson recognised the creative function of religion. As he unfolded in the first of his Gifford lectures at the University of Edinburgh in 1947, religion is an energiser and life-giver. It inspires people with purpose and hope. In all ages, he argued, and I quote, "the first creative works of a culture are due to a religious inspiration and dedicated to a religious end. The temples of the gods are the most enduring works of man. Religion stands at the threshold of all the great literatures of the world. Philosophy is its offspring and is a child which constantly returns to its parent." End quote. Religion is therefore an agent of change. It has revolutionary effects. Yet Dawson also saw the conservative function of religion. It's been noted, as he said in the Gifford lectures, it's been the guardian of tradition, the preserver of the moral law, the educator and the teacher of wisdom. Now, this conservative function is reflected in the root meaning of the word religion, from the Latin word for binding. As the English priest scholar Ronald Knox once explained, religion is something that binds a person, binds him to God. On that account, Knox said, it ties him down and restrains him. It invokes the sanction of a higher power to commit a person to a higher ideal and prevent his lapsing from that ideal. From such binding, from such fundamental loyalty, comes a paradox that is severely alien and seriously objectionable to the contemporary mind. It is that religion, as a binding devotion, leads to true freedom and true creativity. There's a second paradox, and that is that the concept of revolution is not simply an act of overthrowing, but rather of restoring. The word revolution has, of course, undergone a great change of meaning prior to the French Revolution. As the American literary editor Gregory Wolfe has pointed out, the word meant come full circle, as a wheel, as Philippa was saying earlier, as a wheel is rotated until it returns to its original position. So a restoration of order and equilibrium. In this sense, religion is revolutionary in that it seeks to restore a condition that has been lost, a condition of abandoned innocence, calling for reconciliation. So these paradoxes of religion as binding and of revolution as restoring are brought out, I think, very clearly in the writings of G.K. Chesterton. In his inimitable style, he was, as many of you would know, a journalist all his life. Chesterton pointed out on many occasions, and most notably, I think, in the chapter called The Eternal Revolution in his book Orthodoxy, that religion, and in particular Christianity, is truly progressive, because it induces people to persevere and to be devoted and faithful. As he put it, "I could never conceive or tolerate any utopia which did not leave to me the liberty for which I chiefly care, the liberty to bind myself." Now, more than a century ago, Chesterton realised that the tendency to abolish all permanent bonds and loyalties would not bring the social paradise of freedom, but rather the social nightmare of devaluing and trivialising human life and experience. "All my modern utopian friends," he said at one point, "look at each other rather doubtfully, for their ultimate hope, their ultimate hope is the dissolution of all special ties." Similarly, Chesterton believed that the basis of so-called progressive thought was faulty, in that it tended to presume that progress was inevitable and irreversible. It's prone to believe that things are improving over time. But Chesterton argued the opposite, and I quote, "The only real reason for being a progressive," he said, "is that things actually tend to grow worse. The corruption in things is not only the best argument for being progressive, it's the only argument against being conservative. For all conservatism is based upon the idea that if you leave things alone, you leave them as they are. But you do not. If you leave a thing alone, you leave it to a torrent of change. If you leave a white post alone, it will soon be a black post. If you particularly want it to be white, you must always be painting it again. That is, you must be always having a revolution. Briefly," Chesterton concluded, "if you want the old white post, you must have a new white post." End of quote. So even to ensure continuity, Chesterton was saying, one has to be revolutionary. He recognised the restorative intention of revolution, that it's continually striving to put things back in place, to recover a lost condition. For this reason, religion has been the most revolutionary force in the human heart and in history. Now, revolutions, of course, have usually been associated with destruction and even violence. We think of events like the French and American revolutions, many communist revolutions of the past century. Let me propose that religion, while revolutionary, is not destructive, except when it assumes a political character, comes to serve only a political cause, as in the case of the Catholic IRA in Northern Ireland, or liberation theology in Latin America, or Islamist terrorism in the Middle East and elsewhere. But religion is destructive of one thing, namely the ego and the ever-present human temptation to create idols. We think of Les Murray's powerful lines in his poem Church, contrasting Christianity with the false objects of faith founded on self-worship. Les Murray said, "The true God gives his flesh and blood. Idols demand yours off you." So religion challenges the ego and the human tendency to build and worship idols or false gods. And it recognises that breaking away from idols is painful. In this respect, a phrase of the American Catholic short story writer and novelist Flannery O'Connor is telling, I think. O'Connor spoke in a letter on one occasion of the violence of love and commented that in the Christian understanding, grace produces healing, but before it heals, it cuts with the sword Christ said he came to bring. If we're inclined to doubt or don't feel we can argue convincingly that religion is a revolutionary force of profound power and appeal, then we might contemplate the impact of various ideologies that have each adored a golden calf and functioned as a substitute religion over the past century. You can think particularly of communism with its worship of class, Nazism with its worship of race. In Christopher Dawson's mind, communism was remarkably like a religious faith. Russian communism, he said, does resemble a religion in many respects. Its attitude is that of a believer in the gospel of salvation. Lenin is more than a political hero. He is the canonized saint of communism. And the communist ethic is religious in its absoluteness and its unlimited claims to the spiritual allegiance of its followers. Now, such fervent political movements have the force of religion in terms of ultimate loyalties, but they nonetheless operate at an earthly level only and do not really correspond to any genuine transcendental reality. They do not appeal to what Dawson called a higher and more universal range of reality than the finite and temporal world to which the state and the economic order belong. In one of his first books, Progress and Religion, which Philippa mentioned as well, published in 1929, Dawson noted, "Every living culture must possess some spiritual dynamic which provides the energy necessary for that sustained social effort which is civilization. Normally, this dynamic is supplied by a religion, but in exceptional circumstances, the religious impulse may disguise itself under philosophical or political forms." Moreover, he said, "The fact that religion no longer finds a place in social life does not necessarily involve the disappearance of the religious instinct. If the latter is denied its normal expression and driven back upon itself, it may easily become an antisocial force of explosive violence." End of quote. In our time, we've witnessed, as we're well aware, I think, a new substitute religion in the form of an anti-religion, a new idol that has all the hallmarks of religion and yet is opposed to the very idea of religion. I'm referring to the huge surge of secularism in present-day society. And as we're well aware, it's developed from a social condition into a cultural and political ideology, from a situation in which the presence of religion has been quietly understood and practically accepted, into one that increasingly excludes religion and is determined to banish it as socially backward, personally crippling, and politically dangerous. Now, it may reasonably be argued that this anti-religious shift in the form of an ideology is not new, that it springs from the 18th century rationalist enlightenment in particular. But at that stage, the warning signs of where an anti-religious ideology might lead were not fully recognised. In his later writings, and notably, I think, his 1961 book entitled The Crisis of Western Education, Dawson argued that the hopes of the Enlightenment in France were consumed by the savagery that took place at the time of the French Revolution. "There has never been a society," he wrote, "that was more civilised in the humanist sense than the French society of the Enlightenment, nor one more completely convinced of the powers of reason and science to solve all the problems of life and to create a completely rational culture based on a firm foundation of science and philosophy. Yet when this society had the opportunity to put their ideas into practice in the first years of the French Revolution," he said, "they failed disastrously and were themselves destroyed almost to a man by the eruption of the irrational forces that they had released." End of quote. In another book, The Gods of Revolution, which didn't appear until after Dawson's death in 1970, he offered a number of vital insights into the relationship between ideology and action. He argued that it was the intellectual revolution of the French Enlightenment that paved the way for the political revolution, and that the political upheaval could not have taken place without the preceding intellectual revolution. He noted the inherent contradiction between the liberal theory of the French Revolution and the realities of the revolutionary situation as it unfolded in the late 18th century. And he emphasised the extent to which an all-encompassing ideology inspired the mass executions known as the Reign of Terror, which was not confined to those identified as traitors, but rapidly spread to great numbers of bystanders, people who were judged as indifferent and condemned for not actively working for the new order of a regenerated humanity. Dawson himself saw the blending of intellectual and political revolution in 18th century France, in fact, as a prefigurement of totalitarian movements in the 20th century. Well, how does this historical background relate to the rise of modern secularism? I think it might shed light on the ways in which a prevailing ideology that seeks to banish religion can become perverted and engulfed by totalitarian zeal. In a series of lectures delivered at Cambridge on Christianity and culture just before World War II, T.S. Eliot quotes Christopher Dawson, whom he held in very high regard. He was interviewed on one occasion, Eliot, when he went to America, and he was asked who was the most important intellectual in the Western world, and he said Christopher Dawson, and I'm sure to most of the people who heard that name, they didn't know who he was talking about. But anyhow, Eliot quotes Dawson in those lectures on the rise of what Dawson called, rather telling phrase I think, a kind of totalitarian democracy. And this is what Eliot said: that liberalism may be a tendency towards something very different from itself is a possibility in its nature, for it is something which tends to release energy rather than accumulate it, to relax rather than to fortify. It's a movement not so much defined by its end as by its starting point, away from rather than towards something definite. By destroying traditional social habits of the people, Eliot went on, by dissolving their natural collective consciousness into individual constituents, by licensing, wonderful verb there, I think, by licensing the opinions of the most foolish, by substituting instruction for education, by encouraging cleverness rather than wisdom, the upstart rather than the qualified, by fostering a notion of getting on, to which the alternative is a hopeless apathy, liberalism can prepare the way for that which is its own negation, the artificial, mechanised or brutalised control, which is a desperate remedy for its chaos. Let me mention two dimensions of present-day secularism which Dawson identified and which mark, I think, a clear difference from the secularising tendencies of 18th century France. The first is the unitary nature of present-day culture, dominated as it is by technology, conditioned by communications media. Dawson countered the idea that modern culture is pluralistic in character, as is often assumed. On the contrary, he contended, it is, and I quote, more unitary, more uniform, and more highly centralised and organised than any culture the world has known hitherto. Dawson saw the universal nature of contemporary education as being a major cause of this condition. It is very largely funded and controlled by the state, and to that extent, secularist in its assumptions and values. And, he said, it brings the whole of the younger generation under the same influences and ideas during the most impressionable period of their lives. He was, of course, offering these comments decades before the rise of the internet and of social media, and the ways in which these channels of communication actually convey and confirm certain perceptions and assessments more rapidly and more excitedly than ever before. Now, a basic reason for the unitary nature of modern culture and what Dawson saw as its totalitarian tendencies is the rise of mass consciousness. As early as 1939, in a book entitled Beyond Politics, Dawson argued that the liberal ideology of the modern democratic state disguises its totalitarian character. The essence of the totalitarian regime, he believed, was to be found not in dictatorship, and in 1939 there was the dual menace of communism and Nazism, but he said in mass consciousness and mass organisation. It was this condition, particularly at the level of ordinary life, which Dawson saw as leading to the removal of religion from public and cultural life. While he acknowledged that the dictator state, with what he called its militant mass consciousness and ideological fanaticism, was more menacing than the liberal democracies. For in the democracies, he said, minorities still had legal rights, and the survival of a liberal ideology continued to favour religious and other freedoms. But Dawson perceived the same fundamental psychological problem in both cases, and that is, as he said, how the individual and the minority is to resist the pressure of mass opinion and mass emotion, and how it's possible to reconcile spiritual freedom and personal responsibility with the mechanised existence of a unit in the economic machine. End of quote. He noted, perceptively, I think, a critical difference between the well-off and ordinary people. This is what he said. No doubt the rich man, the scientist and the politician enjoy much more freedom under a parliamentary government than under a dictatorship. But the average man and woman, he argued, and still more the average boy and girl, are no more their own masters in the one than in the other. Their minds are moulded and their opinions are formed insensibly by the mass suggestion and mass propaganda of the press, the radio and the cinema. 1939. What would he have said of the vast explosion of communications media in our time? And the only difference, Dawson concluded, is that the fascist and communist states attempt to direct this propaganda in accordance with their respective ideologies, whereas in the democracies, it's a soulless force which is inspired purely by the motive of profit. Now, to highlight a second dimension of the secularism of contemporary culture that Dawson identified, and that is what he called its artificial character, which he believed is unlike anything experienced in previous ages. Our modern Western secularised culture, he said, in The Crisis of Western Education in 1961, is a kind of hothouse growth. On the one hand, man is sheltered from the direct impact of reality, while on the other, he is subjected to a growing pressure which makes for social conformity. He seldom has to think for himself or make vital decisions. His whole life is spent inside highly organised artificial units: factory, trade union, office, civil service, party. And his success or failure, Dawson said, depends on his relations with this organisation. If the church were one of these compulsory organisations, modern man would be religious. But since it's voluntary and makes demands on his spare time, it's felt to be superfluous and unnecessary. How are Christians to overcome this difficulty? Dawson asked. The answer, he said, is not an easy one. For the problem of the conversion of the sub-religious, as he put it, is not unlike the problem of the education of the sub-normal. The only real solution is to change the cultural environment which has made it possible for this unnatural state of things to develop. For the sub-religious is also, in a certain sense, the subhuman. And the fact that apparently healthy and normal individuals can become dehumanised in this way shows that there is something seriously wrong in the society and culture that have made them what they are. End of quote. But while culture and society are unitary, Dawson noted that religion was pluralistic. And the capacity of any particular faith, even one that has been numerically significant in Western society, such as Catholicism, to stand out against the pervasive and overwhelming pressure of the common way of life was extremely limited. I think there continues to be value in Dawson's reflections on the way in which the French Revolution consumed the hopes of the rationalist Enlightenment and exposed them as illusions. Dawson's insights may even serve as a pointer to the final fate of secularism, however dominant it currently seems to be. For any philosophy that does not address the spiritual needs and concerns of people and fails to satisfy the deepest longings of the human heart cannot finally hold sway in a society, despite its apparent dominance and irresistibility. The key feature of a secularist society, I think, is that despite its appearance of openness, it's actually a closed world which lacks any access to transcendental realities, except false ones, as we've been discussing. The contribution of religion, and for Dawson in particular Christianity, is not merely the addition of a religious element to the culture, but rather a prizing open of this closed, self-absorbed world so that human society is invested with a new spiritual purpose and vitality that's capable of transcending the conflicting interests of individual and class and race. Well, let me conclude, ladies and gentlemen, with a reflection of Chesterton's on why religion is so revolutionary and so dangerous. And if I'm quoting Chesterton so much today, and I'm not the first to have done that today or yesterday, it's not only because he said a great deal worth quoting, but he also harboured a deep respect for Christopher Dawson. And I think Chesterton can express in an arresting way many of the insights which Dawson presented learnedly and at length in his many historical studies. Now, in his major work, Orthodoxy, Chesterton ruminated on the common criticism of Christianity that historically it was so obsessed by seemingly small issues of theology. Chesterton spoke of the earthquakes of emotion about a gesture or a word. Why bother when it was only a matter of an inch, he said. But he responded, an inch is everything when you are balancing. And he argued that balance was at the heart of Christianity. The church, he said, could not afford to swerve a hair's breadth on something if she was to continue her great and daring experiment of the irregular equilibrium. Once let one idea become less powerful, and some other idea would become too powerful. It was no flock of sheep the Christian shepherd was leading, but a herd of bulls and tigers, of terrible ideals and devouring doctrines, each one of them strong enough to turn to a false religion and lay waste the world. Remember, Chesterton continued, that the church went in specifically for dangerous ideas. She was a lime tamer. The idea of birth through a Holy Spirit, of the death of a divine being, of the forgiveness of sins, or the fulfilment of prophecies, which anyone can see need but a touch to turn them into something blasphemous or ferocious. If some small mistake were made in doctrine, huge blunders might be made in human happiness. Doctrines had to be defined within strict limits, even in order that man may enjoy general human liberties. The church had to be careful, if only that the world might be careless. Well, I think that sums up in a provocative and popular way, ladies and gentlemen, the revolution of religion and why Dawson's ideas on the impact of religion on culture are so dangerous. Thank you very much.
That was Carl Schmood with The Revolution of Religion, The Dangerous Ideas of Christopher Dawson. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Centre for Cultural Studies 2015 Colloquium, on the theme, Ideas Dangerous to Atheism. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.